Good afternoon. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour, Culture, Current Events Hour, Catholic Faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. A little conversation about this vigilante situation that happened in Washington, D.C. We mentioned that yesterday on the show, but had an expanded Facebook conversation when it comes to gun accessibility, gun laws, lots of opinions out there. Second Amendment stuff, of course, we'll get into that. Also now with a new pick for housing and urban development with Ben Carson, there are many scratching their heads over this decision with a neurosurgeon who, yeah, smart guy, ran for president, but is he qualified for that position? A disturbing accounts of the classic film Last Tango in Paris coming out now this many years after the movie, with the realization that the rape scene was essentially a real rape, at least in the sense that the actress did not rehearse it, did not know what was coming, and the experience that you see there is something disturbing for a reason. We'll get into that and more this afternoon. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown, Almost Hour, back after this.
If you enjoy listening to the Leo Brown Almost Hour, consider becoming a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
You're listening to a Breadbox Media podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon, we're back. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown, Almost Hour, Culture, Current Events Hour, Catholic Faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Over on my Facebook page posted this story about the 1972 movie, The Last Tango in Paris, a movie that I have not seen. I do respect the talent of Marlon Brando, undoubtedly, a guy that obviously just brilliant in a lot of ways. And if you ever saw him in an interview, I often played very interesting characters that just stick in our minds. Godfather, one of probably the biggest, most memorable. But the movie that was shot, again, in 72, just now, after all of these years, the director is basically coming out with a revelation. Bernardo Bertolucci is the director, who says that Maria Schneider, the actress who played the love interest of 48-year-old Marlon Brando as a 19-year-old when she was 19, didn't know the details of this sex scene, which became a rape scene, apparently, and that she never forgave him, and that he feels guilty about not revealing this to her, but he wanted this rawness of this experience to be what it was, and apparently captured on film, one take, got what he was looking for the movie, and she apparently never forgave him for it. So, you know, I think that this is, first off, both actors in the scene are now deceased, so we don't know. We have the director talking about this. Why we're talking about this now, I think, is interesting. You could ask, well, you know, and apparently Schneider, the actress, had plenty to say about this over the years, and she admits to this. But I think in this day and age, with a heightened sense of disparity, right? Disparity between men and women, black and white, rich and poor, you name it. There's a greater growing gap of opportunity and acceptance. This is something that we have to look at, and we have to say, you know, does Hollywood contribute to this? And I think that many would say yes. I don't think you have to look too far to see that even that the pay scale, Hollywood A-listers, men still dominate that more than women. And then for even though it's art imitating life and these things happen, Brando knew what was going on. He was in control of the scene along with the director, and there's something there that, you know, here's a couple of older men. We got this young girl. It's weird. I think we got to just look at it and say it's weird. And it's unfortunate that this would happen. And while art oftentimes will step into territories that we may not necessarily want to see, but it's good to see because it enlightens us to a struggle or an understanding. I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know the content, and I haven't done enough research into it to really know the dynamics. But the other question is, how simply gratuitous is this? Yes, it's obviously an art film, right? It's one of those. Pretty much anything in Brando's repertoire is going to fall into that category because, again, that caliber of actor, that's just the type of material he's going to do. But the other question is it really necessary? But it does bring up a greater question of where are women in these dynamics when it comes to making these decisions? Why didn't she know the full extent of how this scene was going to go? Which apparently she didn't. And, you know, I understand that let's capture it, let's make it real. But if it's so real that someone feels violated, and that's all it takes, right? Did she feel violated? Well, if she felt violated, then she was. And that's something we have to understand as well. So I would hope, that we have come much further than a 1972 mistreatment of a young actress for the sake of art this day and age, but I don't know that we really have, because I think we still have a very one-sided, sexist situation when it comes to a lot of male dominance. And we could argue about theology of the body and who's best designed to do it. That does not mean we disregard, right? Even if, and let's say we just, you want to use the traditional gender roles and say, well, men are, they're the ones who are dominant in this sense because of the very physicality. All right, sure, especially in this sense, especially what we're talking about here, right? But that doesn't mean that there's that it's allowed a total disrespect for a woman. So it's interesting. It's interesting, the conversation that's come up. This, and at the same time, I posted this on my Facebook page as well, new sex shop from Gwyneth Paltrow, which Goop Gifts, I think is what it's called. So it sounds like kind of one of those Spencer's type places, if you ask me, if you remember the Spencer's in the malls, I guess they're still around, where you kind of see a hodgepodge of a lot of weirdness, but her thing is everything from sex toys to caviar. Now, the problem I have with this is more that we're simply putting sex into this category of the exotic and allowing it to be a commodity along with caviar and whatever, I don't know, expensive trinkets and things that are a part of this store. That, as odd as it sounds, is a cheapening of sex, right? If you're just going to put it alongside caviar and, I don't know, I was reading something about a $5,000 little something, I don't know, that's a cheapening of what sex was intended to be, which, again, you could talk about this movie. Where did that draw the line? Because, and again, imitating life through art and seeing the struggles and the challenges and what can come and telling stories with morals, you can do that. You can do that, and it's part of the experience that leads you to a greater understanding. It's not simply putting something out there to equate it to things that it's not, right? So I think there's a difference here. So back to Last Tango in Paris, if that movie, aside from the fact that the young actress didn't know what was going on, if it actually tells a redeeming story, even through what some would consider gratuitous, it's redemptive because of what it is the piece of art, the work that it's bringing this story into play. Now, should the actress have known all of that? Well, that's another issue altogether. I'm thinking about generally looking at the theme of this movie, the message that's there, and do we get the redemption? Do we get to that part of redemption? And are the scenes, although they may be graphic, are they simply gratuitous or are they telling a story? See, now we're in a different world. And there really is a fine line between this, and there really is a distinguishing point that one is okay and the other is not. So then putting sex toys alongside caviar in a bizarre Gwyneth Paltrow shop, that's a cheapening, because that's not how sex is supposed to be expressed between man and woman for life, open to life. That's a completely different area of expression, and certainly not something that should be sold as a commodity on the shelves of a fancy boutique. So I hope that makes sense, because there's all kinds of nuances when you get into how this part of life is expressed and how it is portrayed. And there's some things that are clearly you can question some, but then ask ultimately, where does this lead? Where are we going? In cinema, if it's not just strictly porn, which that's always wrong, but if it's expressed and shown and leading you through a story of redemption, wow, you know, that's a powerful expression. That's something that actually teaches us something about what's happening and shows the devastation that could be a part of treating this gift inappropriately, right? I mean, we could see that, at least, but then the other there's nothing there. There's nothing redemptive. There's nothing that will lead us through an exploration of understanding. There's nothing that's going to cause us to stop and really wrangle and wrestle with these issues. You're just going to see this stuff in a shop and be like, okay, all right. And it may be fascinating to some who think that this is interesting or neat or expressive or whatever it may be, but ultimately, it's just a degradation. So I know that I see things differently. I get that. I have these kind of conversations with friends on Facebook, and yeah, I'm not going to twist anybody's arm into saying things my way. But I think it's interesting from a Catholic perspective, when you have this worldview and the things that we talk about with Father Thomas Loy on a weekly basis, you can really begin to start seeing the discernment in these areas. And it's interesting. More to come. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour, back after this.
You're listening to a Breadbox Media podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back in Leo Brown. Leo Brown Almost Hour. Culture, Current Events Hour, Catholic Faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Talked about the story out of Washington, D.C., where this vigilante decided to take matters into his own hands when it came to the what he thought was real but was fake news that Hillary Clinton was somehow running a child something, exploitative thing in a pizza place. And so he decides to walk in with an assault rifle and take matters into his own hands. That's where it all started. And then I kind of said, well, isn't it comforting to know that, you know, there are those out there willing to do this in kind of my generally hyperbolic, facetious fashion, which then sparked interesting conversation. And there was apparently a National Review article talking about the safety of those who do carry guns that they find that there's something actually much. They are prepared. They're capable. And yeah, then you equate that to what happened on September 11th, and no gun's going to fix that, right? It doesn't matter. You can think that you're protected, and you know, I think this is a bigger philosophical and theological question, really, is, you know, how safe are you? And do you need to be? Should we be, right? Is it part of the equation? There's something beautiful about flying without the net. I'm not saying not have a plan, and I'm not saying not have some degree of sensibility about you, and you can do that and not be reckless, right? That's the beauty of faith, and I think that that's something that I've been reading a lot over the past several weeks, and fasting, and really kind of examining where I stand on issues. And one particular book I'm reading is talking about this concept of construction, deconstruction, and reconstruction, and in relation to priest, prophet, king, which I don't think the author gets quite as detailed into that as I kind of started connecting this as I thought about it. And I thought, wow, how interesting and illustrative is this example of what it means to have these three dynamics of Christ and us, right? Because this is the bizarre, beautiful, amazing, comforting. You want security. This is where it's at, right? It's not in carrying a gun. That may make you feel safe, but you're still not safe. Here's where safety is, right? Here's where it's safe. And this is beautiful. So there's an understanding that we have, that Christ has two natures, right? Human and man. We call this the hypostatic union, this connection of God and man. But because of the incarnation, because Christ became man, we share in his nature. We are created in the image and likeness of God. That image and likeness of God is Jesus, right? Jesus is the image and likeness of God. Therefore, our creation, because we are in that beautiful mystery, we have a dual nature as well. We have a bit of divinity and a bit of humanity. Not that we are divine by any means, but we share in an image and likeness. So what we can do with that then is we're both bride and we're bridegroom. We're both Christ's bride, and there are times we represent Christ to others. And it's whatever relationship we happen to be in, but that relationship is always the same. It's a both and. It's happening all at the same time. And I know that we like to compartmentalize and go, okay, well, this is over here and this is over here, and it makes it cleaner. I get that. But there's a beautiful mess that's happening here that's really not a mess at all. It's just everything working in conjunction. So hear this and try to understand what I'm saying, if I can even express it. So when we're in relationship with Jesus, which is constantly, but in that relationship, we act as bride. And we act as bride with Christ to be receptive to his will. Now, those who are brides, literally, women, are not necessarily expected to act in receptivity to the will of your husband on every possible thing, regardless. But we are, as a bride of Christ. That's how we act. That's how we that's our role in that receptivity. We are there to simply be receptive. And through receptivity, we cooperate with the will and grace of God. That's how we cooperate. Through that receptivity, in this very docile, a willingness to be influenced, that's what it's about, right? The docility that's there. But you compare that to what it looks like in relation with others. And in relation with others, now we're not receptive to them. We don't have to be that bride-like expression of a relationship as we are with Jesus, we're not necessarily there to be swayed and influenced. Now, it's good if people can sway and influence you if you're willing to defer to them on issues. That's a beautiful way of having a relationship. But that's not what it's about necessarily in the relationship to our faith. Now we're priest, prophet, and king, because this is what's promised to Jesus, of Jesus to us, as he is priest, prophet, and king. So there with dealing with others, we have three specific roles. And the priest, we construct. As a priest, we help build stability. We help build order. The priest is there to order the worship, the temple worship in the Old Testament, to enter into the Holy of Holies, to be the one who is able and capable of doing that, this very distinctive order that's a part of it. But as prophets come along and now they deconstruct, right? And it's all about let's shatter the whatever you thought it was, because you know what? We're going to speak prophetically. We're going to listen to the Word of God. We're going to look at doing something completely radically different, because the time has come for change. This is what we see in Jesus, right? It's why he was crucified, because he challenged the status quo so and just ridiculously, to the point that the Sadducees and the Pharisees had nothing but problems dealing with this guy, accepting what he was bringing to the equation. So we're called to do that in relation with others. We're called to find ways to break molds and go, wait a minute, let's look at this differently. Let's tear this thing down. Let's take away your security here for a reason, because we're going to build it back in a better way. And, you know, we don't do this with kids necessarily. We do this with mature adults who've reached a point that they need to be shaken. So there are times where we have to build, we have to construct, especially those who haven't gotten even to the point of having that stability. And this would be maybe children and young adults. We get to this point, then there's a time where we have to break it all down. And then in the role of king, it's reconstruction. Right? Reconstruction to the point that we are going to build this back with a true structure, not this just smaller, more insular sort of understanding of the priest mode, nor is it going to look like it's quite as deconstructed as the prophet mode. But now it's coming into the kingship. And now what happens is it's a kingdom, right? And this is bigger. It's bigger because there are, it's a place, right? There's a physical understanding of this is where it is. And within this kingdom, we honor and respect the king, and we do what he asks of us out of respect and out of appreciation for the fact that he has our best interest at heart and he is wanting to guide us in the best direction. This is our role as king. So priest, prophet, and king, when we deal with others, we're going to look for these opportunities to find where they are on the journey and what do we need to be to them? What is our gift to them at that point? And think about this. If we really did that, if we really embraced this, and I know I'm talking crazy, I know that if anything that I've said in the past 10 minutes makes any sense at all, I'll be amazed. But just think about this. If it did make sense, if it really made sense to the point that we could begin to embrace this understanding of being this to each other, what we're going to do is hold these beautiful mirrors and help others along in their journey. Now, I know some people just want to be heard. I get that. And they are not necessarily looking for our advice. If I come to talk to you, I'm looking for your advice. And just so you know, I'm blessed beyond measure because I have so many advisors. I have a literal team of advisors who I've asked to be, I've invited them to help me break things down and pick things apart. I rely on them so much. And I really, you know, I'm looking for that. I'm looking for that. Some to help me kind of shore things up in the beginning and kind of give me some construction and development and say, okay, this is how it's going to be. Then I need those just to shatter it all to pieces and to break it all apart and say, nothing fits in there anymore. Forget about that. I need those who are going to come to me and say, let's look how big this thing really is. When you reconstruct all these pieces that are out there, or better yet, think about the shattering of the pieces, and the pieces are growing other plants, because now those pieces are seeds that have grown into this kingdom, right? I mean, it's a beautiful understanding. You want security? There it is. There it is. It's not in owning a firearm, carrying a firearm, being a vigilante, any of this stuff. You want security? Be the bride of Christ. Be receptive. Accept that grace and that will of God, and then go be the priest, prophet, and king to everyone else that you encounter. Watch what will happen. More to come. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour. Back after this.
If you like what you're hearing, become a friend of the show. Visit RedboxMedia.com and click Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Good afternoon. We are back. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown Almost Hour. Culture, Current Events Hour. Catholic Faith. 50 minutes every afternoon. So Ben Carson, now been appointed by President-elect Trump to run the housing and urban development position. And lots of questions, I think, you know, is Carson the best for the job? I think Carson's bright, obviously. I think he is very perceptive and receptive. My guess is that this would be good for any appointed position over a division of this nature, and maybe so, maybe so. Now, there's been some degree of criticism over Trump choosing Carson, those who, and even I thought this, got to admit that, okay, well, he's maybe one of the only black guys that Trump knows, therefore he's thinking urban, black, therefore I'll choose Carson. Maybe. More thought went into it than that, but it's easy to kind of think that on the surface. But the fact remains that there's positions that have to be filled. Trump's going to do that, and we got to see where this goes. Now, one interesting thing, I did post this, and I get some reposts off of it because people are saying, well, this, we're not hearing about this. It came from Slate. Slate is more left-leaning. Again, as I always say, everything from Mother Jones to Alex Jones and everything in between. So I'm out there on left and right media all the time looking for various positions, because that's how I discern, right? I'm going to find the balance. I'm going to come to some sort of consensus through all of that based on what I'm seeing out there. So this story appears on Slate, where apparently the former Alaskan governor, Sarah Palin, says there's a problem with crony capitalism on this carrier deal, right? And basically saying, if we're going to go down this road as conservatives, we're no better than liberals, which is interesting that she would say this, given the fact that she's been a pretty alt-right leaning individual. She's got her ideals when it comes to conservatism. And then for her to say something of this nature, which seems to be antithetical, at least to the Trump position, that this is how you help American businesses. My question about it was simply, is this just corporate welfare, or is this really something different? Because if you're going to call it something different, but it's going to be treated in the same fashion as basically a handout, and I've been through the discussions, quote unquote, the arguments on this, that there are those who say, well, Leo, you're not seeing this because it's not a handout. It's a tax break. Yes, it's a tax break to prevent a company from having to outsource its jobs. Well, if somebody's at a point of having to outsource their jobs, they're probably looking at their long-term chances of success and saying, well, we probably need to hedge our bets a little bit differently. Therefore, it looks to me like it's a bailout. You can call it what it is, or what you think it is, I should say. See it as you will. It's got all of the characteristics of the duck. It quacks, it walks, it swims. It has to be a duck. Again, disagree all you want, but I think Sarah Palin's seeing it, interestingly enough. So we got to wonder where it's going and what this really means. And yeah, I've been saying it all along, and I still believe this. In my opinion, I don't see Donald Trump that different than I do any other politician. Now, there are plenty who see that and say I'm wrong and say, Leo, he's an outsider. He's going to do things differently. Well, then do things differently. One thing I say is you want to stimulate, and maybe there's something coming and we haven't seen it yet, but you want to stimulate business. How about this? You know, when the toughest part of a business is the first 3 to 5 years, that's when 90% of the businesses fail. That's when you incentivize, but you don't incentivize because if you're incentivizing there, it can't be a bailout because there's nobody bailing out. It's a startup. So how about real incentives for startups that says, hey, we're going to give crazy tax credits to these guys. So your first 5 years of payroll, basically it's free. Now you're talking about putting people to work and letting companies that are tight on cash, incredibly cash strapped in their startup time as they try to make things happen. Now they can flourish. They can get out and do things that they were intending to do as opposed to constantly be worried about how the next dollar is coming along. And if you stimulate those new businesses, those young businesses, especially, I mean, you know, and I almost started to say, if you want to qualify with some sort of, it needs to meet a requirement that says it's going to grow to this, but we never know. You never know what business is going to grow. I think all of us who start out in business, we're planning on huge success, right? We want it to be. But what if it's simpler than that? Hey, here it is, brand new businesses, and you have employees. You're going to bring jobs to the table? Okay, here's what you're going to do. We're going to give you tax credits on all of your payroll liabilities for the next 3 years? Let's just be reasonable. Let's say 3 years. Third year, hey, if something's looking good, then we'll start in with the contributions on that. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that eats small businesses alive to the point that they simply cannot stay afloat because it's just not there. And what a beautiful way to say, okay, this is how we grow. We're doing something brand new. Now you've kind of back to what we were talking about earlier. You've deconstructed and now you're beginning to reconstruct in a way that says, here's real opportunity. You're not just going to look at big multi-million dollar companies and say, how do we keep you, make sure that you keep jobs in the U.S.? We're going to create jobs in the U.S. We're going to create jobs through what has always been our greatest resource, human resource. We're going to create it through human ingenuity, and we're going to give all of those ideas the best opportunity. Because here's the deal. If you don't do that, it doesn't matter anyway. These businesses are largely going to fail, and the government's never going to see their tax money anyway. So why not just anticipate that and create this opportunity that could really grow something? I think there'd be a lot of bipartisan enthusiasm behind that. I may be wrong, but to me that sounds like an idea that there are those who would say, yeah, well, why wouldn't we stimulate our small business sector? If it's true, which supposedly this is the bread and butter and this is where it all comes from in the U.S., is that it's those small businesses, the under $1 million annual revenue, that really drive our economy. If that is truly the case, well, let's do everything we can for them. Let's make sure that they get the right resourcing. And then let's have some sort of, you ready for this one? Mm-hmm. How about a tax advantage to investors? So instead of a potential capital gains of somebody who is going to have to pay tax money, let's open up a special tax deduction category for investment that looks very similar to a 501c3. That if somebody is in a qualifying, right? So it need to be a qualifying startup. And I think this is where you would need to really kind of have a team of discernment on this when it comes to looking at how this works. It would have to meet certain criteria and it had to be verified. This would prevent somebody from reinvesting back into their own company that's been established and then finding a tax loophole. That's not what I'm saying. Back to this startup grit of the early adopting, getting things off the ground, putting the pieces together, incentivize that. Find a way for government-supported venture capital that comes through investments that would normally have been taxed. Now you're stimulating your economy. You're building your kingdom, right? You're now growing this in a different fashion. We're not playing by the old rules anymore. We're looking at how do we really do this well? How does government then become a friend of business early on, not just later on because they made some sort of campaign promise, maybe gotten a contribution to their cause, maybe gotten some handshakes of promises and saying that we're going to make sure this is taken care of. There's nothing crony about saying, here's how we get new businesses going. Here's how we get new female-led businesses going, new minority-led businesses going. Right? And there can be even special categories for these that give them even more incentive to succeed. If we started doing this kind of stuff, we're thinking completely differently than we ever have before. And we are beginning to say Wall Street is really concerned about Main Street. Because without Main Street, there wouldn't be a Wall Street. The government, on the biggest level possible, wants to do everything we can in local communities. See, it's that subsidiarity, solidarity model. Can we bring all of this together that says, hey, no, we're going to stimulate the heck out of all kinds of new business opportunities. We're going to stimulate the heck out of all kinds of new ideas, innovations, inventions, new product lines, solutions, making people's lives better, or, you know what, just making people's lives more enriched. Doesn't always have to solve a problem. Sure, that's great if it does, but that's not necessarily what it's about. It's just about finding ways for us all to work together in ways that really look like something. And not just look like favoritism, cronyism, corporate welfare, whatever it may be. Must find ways to do it. I mean, I think as crazy as that sounds, I know I'm no economist, I'm no politician, I'm a guy with a small business, right? Who would hope to see it bigger. And those incentives, I think, would be the way to make that happen. Something to think about. That's all we have time for this afternoon. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour. God bless.
If you enjoy listening to the Leo Brown Almost Hour, consider becoming a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.